Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy. 65 years ago, the Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court decision found that separate was not equal. We'll talk with the organizers of a Penn State conference on the historic case about school segregation then and now. Crystal Sanders is an associate professor of history and director of the Africana Research Center at Penn State. Erica Frankenberg is associate professor of education and demography and director of the Center for Education and Civil Rights at Penn State. Our guest host for today's interview is Jenna Spinelli, host of the Democracy Works podcast produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State in collaboration with WPSU.
This is Jenna Spinelli here today with Erica Frankenberg and Crystal Sanders. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting us.
So we're talking today all about school segregation and the Brown v. Board of Education decision. Before we get into kind of the current state of affairs, I wanted to go back and talk a little bit about the years, kind of the time leading up to the decision in 54. We talk a lot on this show about social movements, kind of bottom up. Civil rights and some of the movements that have happened abroad. And in reading about the case, going back through the decision, it seems like this was maybe more top down as opposed to bottom up. Or at least that's how it's portrayed. I'm curious from your perspective, you know, what was the kind of social climate like, social movements leading up to the decision?
Well, thank you so much for having us, Jenna. I think it's an exciting time to talk about Brown. While we could think of this as a top-down decision in the sense that justices unanimously struck down segregation in public education, there were many people on the ground, black teachers, black principals, black parents, who had been organizing for generations for quality educational opportunities for their students. So we can't forget them as we remember this milestone, right? 1954 is a watershed year. But years, decades prior to 1954, black parents were mobilizing to ensure that their students had the resources they needed, the textbooks they needed, to ensure that their students had transportation to get to school. So we can't leave them out of this equation.
The other point I'd just make is that there's a lot of writing about the importance of social movements and trying to lay the groundwork for Brown, and that, in fact, white elite public opinion had shifted in recent years. And that was really important because there had been many cases, of course, that said that Plessy did not need to be overturned. And it was that shift after the Cold War had begun that suddenly this didn't really comport with our ideals abroad. And so having a chief justice who was a former politician, in fact, the governor of California who had interred Japanese during World War II, I think, made him really attentive to thinking about what the court's decision would say and making sure, as Crystal mentioned, that it would be a unanimous decision.
Crystal, as you mentioned, we are 65 years from the decision in 54. So as we think about that time that has elapsed since then, did the vision of what the courts and others were hoping to achieve in Brown ever come to fruition in those intervening years?
Well, we need to think first about the initial responses to the decision. And there was massive resistance across the United States, not just in the South. I think of Dwight Eisenhower in 1957 when he sends troops to Little Rock. He essentially says, I'm doing this because the rest of the world is watching and laughing at us. He did not agree with the decision. He regretted appointing Earl Warren to the court. And so when we have that type of resistance from our highest political leader, what can we expect on the ground? And so we see massive resistance. We see white parents taking their kids out of public schools. We see entire school systems shutting down, as was the case in Prince Edward County, Virginia. We see very slow efforts to actually comply with the law. So when we think about Brown 1954, we don't see mandatory widespread desegregation in the South until the 1969-1970 academic year. So between that interim of 54 to 69, we see freedom of choice plans that were really token desegregation plans, ways to evade the court order. We see black parents consistently going into court, wanting enforcement of the Brown decision. We see school systems dragging their feet. We see Congress, people like Adam Clayton Powell, trying to use federal dollars as a way to move the needle toward desegregation. You know, I call it the Powell Amendment, right? Suggesting that schools that receive federal funds could not continue to practice desegregation. And so this is, it takes a very long time before we even began to see real implementation of the court order. So we do begin to see it by the early 1970s. Yet today in 2019, we find ourselves really in a situation where our schools are beginning to look not much different than they did in 1960. We see widespread resegregation across the country.
Yeah, and what are some of the factors that are leading to that resegregation?
Well, one of the things that most people might not be aware of, but that more than I believe 25 states allow, is for communities to succeed from a school system and create their own new school system. And so across the country, but especially in wealthy suburbs and southern states, we see wealthy white communities pull out from school systems and create their own new school system that allows them to maintain racial segregation. We've also seen white flight. We've seen large numbers of segregationist academies that came into existence in the wake of Brown continue to be these very strong and successful institutions in the 21st century. There are many ways in which white parents have been able to really not just avoid, but flee from public school systems across the country.
Right. And when you say, white families are creating their own school systems, do you mean charter schools or do you mean actually public schools?
I mean public schools. So, yes, we do see charter schools rising up and creating problems in terms of allowing for diverse classrooms. But these are parents and communities that are creating school systems. It is actually legal.
So I've studied the issue of school district secession. I think in the South, there have been several dozen that have happened since 2000 alone. Alabama, a state that I've studied, has one of the most permissive school district secession laws, in which you, as long as you're a town of 5,000, you can vote to leave a countywide district. And why this is so important, just to underline a point that Crystal was making, is the South has been the most integrated region of the country in terms of desegregation in schools since 1970. And there are a couple of factors. One is the importance of court order desegregation that applied to virtually every district in the South. But the second is the predominance of larger countywide districts. And so why that matters is, in contrast to like the Northeast or the Midwest, it has dozens, if not hundreds, of school districts in the same metropolitan area. A countywide district can encompass both the city and the suburbs within one district, and that allows you to assign students across those lines of difference. Whereas you can't do that when there are district boundary lines in the way. You can, but people don't do it in the Northeast or Midwest. And so the fragmentation is really going to limit this demographic advantage that the South has had by creating these pockets of new school districts that will make the South resemble areas of like the Northeast, for example.
What was going on in the North and in other parts of the country at the time, even though there was not maybe legalized segregation, but I'm sure it was still going on?
Yeah, I think that this is a really important question to ask. And both Crystal and I are natives of the South, so I think it's important to think about how school desegregation looked different in the South versus the North. And of course, there is a really important historical difference in the segregation laws that did exist before Brown in 17 states and the District of Columbia. However, in northern states, there were a lot of ways in which structures were used to create segregated schools as well. There was this intervening period of time, the first two decades after the Brown decision, in which there were a lot of questions legally as to how Brown would apply outside of the South. And so, I've studied some of those decisions, trying to look at judges who are really wrestling with what is de facto, what is de jure, what needs to be remedied. And they weren't
Can you explain what those two terms
are? Sure, sure. De jure is segregation by law. So you can think of a state that had a law saying black and white children cannot go to the same school. That's sort of the most crystal clear version of it, versus de facto is segregation that happens in fact. So this is using neighborhood schools. So say you will go to the school closest to you when you're relying on the fact that, oh, by the way, those neighborhoods are segregated in part because of governmental policies. So that was quite common in the North. It was a tool that was being used in the South, but eventually the Supreme Court said in districts that had formerly been segregated, that was unconstitutional. That didn't go far enough, but never applied that outside of the South. And so then by 1974, the Supreme Court had really started to more officially close the door on de facto segregation, which really limited efforts in the Northeast, the Midwest, other regions of the country. But between 54 and 74, there was really a question around, both because of Brown, but also because of the 1964 Civil Rights Act that Crystal alluded to that contained the Powell Amendment as Title VI. There were questions about, can districts that are relying like on neighborhood schools or permissive transfer laws in the North, is that something that they should have their funds cut off too, the way Southern districts were? And a lot of Southerners, you know, rightfully got upset at Northern liberals who were passing civil rights laws that affected the South, but were constructed not to affect segregated patterns in the Northeast.
One of the things that I feel like, Erica, you're alluding to is the connection between income and race. And when we think of resegregation today, whether we're talking about the North and the South, we have to look at housing patterns. We have to look at the lack of affordable housing and the ways in which we still have very weak fair housing laws. And that has been detrimental to ensuring that our public schools are as diverse and inclusive as they can and should be.
In going back and looking at Justice Warren's opinion in the Brown case, he specifically called out, education's role as a public good and as an essential part of a healthy democratic society. So I'm just wondering if that same sentiment still exists today of K-12 education as a public good and as a basis for a healthy democracy, you know, where that stands today.
If we can't think about public schools as helping all of our children and are just thinking of how is it going to help my children, we're going to approach our public schools and the kind of actions that we're okay with in very different ways. So secession becomes suddenly much more rational if you're worried about how am I going to get the relative advantage for my child or children who look like my children. Or even thinking of it, how is it going to help my home value? Because, of course, home values, because of the geographic nature of school districts, are affected by the perceived quality of schools. And then, of course, property tax funding. So all of these are intricately related. But I think the way in which we've shifted from what I think is a really beautiful rendition of the importance of public schools, and again, not to increase achievement, right? He was talking about citizens in our democracy.
I believe that most Americans still believe that public education is a public good. I don't believe that most Americans believe integration is a public good. So those are two separate things. The way we see parents of all races, of all classes, mobilizing and advocating on behalf of their children lets us know that there's still some investment in public education, but there is no investment in integration as a public good. And so if we think about having diverse schools as a way to prepare our students to be productive citizens living in a diverse world, being a participant in a diverse workforce, that's where we can push back against these efforts against making integration a priority.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Note on WPSU. We're talking with Penn State professors Crystal Sanders and Erica Frankenberg. They're the organizers of a national symposium on the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court case. Our guest host for today's interview is Jenna Spinelli, host of the Democracy Works podcast, produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State, in collaboration with WPSU.
I know you've studied some of the outcomes that come as a result of integration. So what do we know about how students perceive each other, kind of how they perceive the world at large based on the type of school environment that they're in?
Yeah, I think there's been a body of research that I sort of crystallize into two camps. One is the benefits of integrated schools for all students, and that there are a range of social and psychological benefits. So you're less likely to have racial stereotypes, prejudice formation, particularly when it happens in the early grade. And of course, we're also assuming that diverse schools are integrated within the schools as well. Mm-hmm. And so there are really important benefits there. There are important benefits in terms of being more likely to live and work in diverse spaces as an adult. Some research even finds you're more likely to live in more integrated neighborhoods. So really, if, and this was part of the strategy for why you should attack K-12 school segregation in the 1950s, was that it's the key institution where, you know, most of our people are still a part of. And so if you get integration there, they are comfortable, they'll be then more likely to desegregate. So there are these perpetuating benefits of integration that I think are really important. And then the second are, you know, despite the heroic efforts, I think, of many communities, we have not historically ever given the same kind of resources to segregated minority schools.
And I just want to kind of underscore two points that Erica raised. The first is that you talked about making sure that there's real desegregation within diverse schools. And that's important because it's not just making sure that Black and white or Hispanic or Latino students are in the same school building, but making sure that they're actually in classes together. Unfortunately, we find that even in some diverse schools on paper, tracking has ensured that you still have all white classrooms and all Black classrooms within what's quote unquote a diverse institution or a diverse school. So we have to make sure that when we talk about desegregation, we're not just ensuring that students are at the same institutions, but ensuring that students are not being tracked, ensuring that students are sitting in classrooms with people who don't look like them, who don't have the exact same experiences that they have. And the other thing, Erica, that you alluded to when you talked about historically segregated schools have been under-resourced. Even today, when we look at schools that are high poverty, high population of minority students, those tend to be the schools with the least experienced teachers. Mm-hmm. Those tend to be the schools that don't have advanced placement and IB programs. Those tend to be the schools that don't have the same extracurricular opportunities. So it's imperative, right? We're going to ensure that every child, no matter where he or she lives, no matter where he or she's family is from, has access to a quality education and has the opportunity to reach his or her highest potential. We need to ensure that all of those students are attending diverse, integrated schools.
Yeah, so these are all, you know, really big societal, social kind of issues. So what, you know, who needs to be at the table in order to move the needle on integration? And are there any models or any approaches that you've found in your research that have been particularly useful in moving things forward?
Yeah, I think it's an issue that is comprehensive in nature, and so it's going to require a comprehensive solution. And it's just even more important than it was at the time of Brown because we now have a majority students of color in our public schools. So there is, I think, an increased demographic urgency to why we have to get this right for our 21st century. I think that we need to have educators and community members from all different backgrounds at the table. We need to have colleges of education at the table. Universities can play an important role. Politicians, you know, most of the desegregation now or integration is not like it was after Brown. It's not court ordered. It's not mandatorily busing people across town. It's voluntarily designed in nature. And so I think first you, again, have to think about framing this and how we talk about it as being good for all children and for our community. And I think there's a lot of research to back that up. But then I think you have to think about what kind of strategies are you going to use both to get the schools diverse, but then also to make sure that the schools that are diverse are integrated within them. One important part after Brown was making sure that you had a diverse faculty and staff, because that reflects too whether it was considered to be a Black school or a white school. You know, there is really important reasons for both white students and students of color to have a diverse faculty. So then you need maybe teachers unions at the table. So it really takes leadership articulating why this matters, even if it might mean that some parents will not get maybe what they initially considered to be the first choice for their kid, that it's still in the best benefit for the entire community.
Yeah, and are there particular cities or particular communities that have been particularly successful at doing some of these things?
Sure. I mean, I think no district is perfect, but there are a couple of communities that I think are really intriguing. So Jefferson County, Kentucky is where Louisville is. They had court-ordered desegregation in the 1970s. They merged the city and the county district. And they were throwing like rocks at the bus, I think, initially. Their court order ended in 2000. The court said they had met the requirements under the changing Supreme Court law. And the district said, you know what, we have understood how vital this is, so we're going to voluntarily continue this. And their policies were challenged. They went to the Supreme Court, and they were struck down in 2007 in a decision that I think was a real setback for integration efforts. However, they went back to the drawing board. They revised their policy twice. And so today they use a really intriguing policy design. But even more than that, I'm impressed with the political will. They were challenged in state court after that, federal court. The state legislature has gone after them a bunch of times. And they have maintained it. And it's been hard. And they have had some parents who are upset that their child can't always go to the closest school. But continuing to talk about why integration matters has been, you know, that, so that's an example I always hold up.
And as a North Carolinian, I must add the Wake County school system that's done a phenomenal job in ensuring that they have diverse schools across the district. Like Jefferson County, there used to be the Raleigh City Schools and then the Wake County School District. They merged in the late 1960s, early 1970s, and they created a plan that used race to ensure that all of the high schools in the district had basically equal levels or proportional levels of students of different populations. And I have to say, charter schools have been one of the reasons that we've seen widespread resegregation across the state of North Carolina. Until the mid-2000s, North Carolina had a cap on charter schools. I believe it was one per county. We have 100 counties. That meant we were not to have more than 100 charter schools. That cap was taken off by our state legislature a few years ago, and there has been an explosion of charter schools. We are seeing parents flee the traditional public schools in droves. And it's a nightmare. It's quite upsetting to see what had been, you know, such a crown jewel for our state, our public school system, to now be divided in this way. And we're seeing the siphoning off of resources.
Can I please leave us on a slightly hopeful note?
Sure,
because
I do
share Crystal's larger outlook. One of the things that a lot of integration advocates talk about is New York and how about 5 years ago, some of my colleagues wrote a report on the state of segregation in New York, and they said New York is the most segregated state in the country. Well, New Yorkers didn't take that too well, right? Shame can sometimes be a powerful motivating force. And they have really, in that time in state government, really taken a lot of efforts to provide incentives for integration. Now, some of it's been for socioeconomic instead of race, and so, you know, there's a lot of complexity there. The same thing for the New York City schools. They have a lot of challenges, as we've seen from headlines in the recent months. But there are a number of community districts there who are trying to address the segregation that's been persisting for decades. And so I am hopeful that there are states like that. But, you know, I do think of the Deep South where I grew up, and places like that in which you may not have those same kind of state incentives or state civil rights groups that had the same input as in New York. And so how, as a country, do we bring all states along? And I think that's the struggle for the next generation.
And thank you both for the work that you're doing to help bring these issues to the forefront. And I know you're organizing the Brown at 65 conference, which will bring lots of scholars and others together to think about how to move the needle on some of these things. So we're going to end now with our four Mood of the Nation poll questions. So thinking about American politics, what makes you angry?
What makes me angry at this moment is the number of well-qualified candidates like Stacey Abrams, who are cheated out of elections because of voter suppression and all other types of, you know, efforts to remove eligible voters from our rolls and to limit who participates in the democratic process. That makes me really angry.
What makes me angry is the way in which we're framing a lot of how we talk about our politics in ways that I think only further polarization.
And what makes you proud?
Being on a college campus every day, one of the things that really makes me proud is to see young people engaged in the political process. When I have students come up to me after class and say, can I pass out voter registration forms? And I say, of course, you know, as long as this is nonpartisan, feel free to engage or encourage your peers to take part in our, you know, political process. So that makes me proud. That makes me excited about the future. That lets me know that we still have young people engaged. We still have young people believing that change is possible and that they have a role to play in our democracy.
What makes me proud is thinking about the many individual acts of courage that have helped make our country live up a little bit more to what we think it aspires to. And seeing teachers who even, you know, the teacher of my 3-year-old, teaching them how to stand up and be activists for justice.
And what makes you worry?
Oh, I've seen a lot of disillusionment, a lot of apathy, a lot of decisions to sit out elections, believing that, you know, people's votes don't matter, that people's votes will not count. And that's quite troubling. We know that for a healthy, vibrant democracy, we need an engaged and active and informed electorate. So I'm worried that if we continue to see high levels of disillusionment and high levels of apathy, we will continue to have elections that are not made up of the, you know, the majority of voters.
I worry about the siphoning off of public dollars the way we've been talking about from education. I believe Warren was right that public education is crucial to our democracy. And if we're pulling money away from K-12 schools and higher education, I think we're limiting the ability to robustly prepare our citizens of the future.
And then finally, what gives you hope?
I must say that the 2018 midterm elections have given me a lot of hope in the sense that we had so many diverse winners. We've got more women serving in Congress than ever before. I believe it was New Mexico that elected the first Democratic Latina governor. We have 2 Muslim women serving in Congress right now. We saw large numbers of Black women elected to Congress, including the first from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So that gives me hope, right? We're seeing that Americans are coming together and they're responding and they're trying to create a government that's representative of the people in various ways.
I hope this doesn't sound not quite so hopeful, but I still got a lot of hope from the election of Barack Obama. I grew up in a district that really fought desegregation and would have, you know, fought a lot of Black political power. And to see us as a nation elect him is something that still gives me hope.
Well, we will leave it there. Of Crystal and Erica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Crystal Sanders is an associate professor of history and director of the Africana Research Center at Penn State. Erica Frankenberg is associate professor of education and demography and director of the Center for Education and Civil Rights at Penn State. They talked about the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court case 65 years later. Our guest host today was Jenna Spinelli, host of the Democracy Works podcast, produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State, in collaboration with WPSU. You can hear more Take Note interviews at WPSU.org. I'm Emily Reddy, WPSU.